Hi there, Greg Page, the original Yellow Wiggle here, and you're listening to the Savvy Dentist Podcast.
Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Hello everyone, it's Jesse Green here. Welcome back to SavvyDentist.com and to the Savvy Dentist Podcast. It's great to have your company for another episode of the show. Now, my guest today really needs no introduction. He is best known as one of the founding members of one of Australia's most successful bands. He's toured the world, played the packed arenas. He's the driver of the big red car. He's got a wonderful friend called Dorothy. He's the wearer of the yellow skivvy. And of course, I'm referring to the one and only Greg Page from The Wiggles. Welcome, Greg. Thank you so much for taking the time to come and hang with us today, mate.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jesse.
Greg, you know, The Wiggles, I think every parent, every child knows The Wiggles. I certainly grew up with our kids, you know, listening to all of your music, watching the DVDs as it was back then. I could probably recount all the songs. You know, as I was telling my kids that we're talking today, my social credit has certainly gone up a few notches, so it's good to talk to you.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, mate.
Mate, I'm curious to ask about your background because in my research for you, you're a multi-instrumentalist, as I understand it. You can play guitar, drums, keyboard. You obviously sing. What was life in the Page household growing up? Was it always musical? What was it like growing up?
Yeah, it was always musical for me. And when you say I can play all those instruments, I can play them all, but very badly, very marginally. But I enjoy it. And I think that's the thing with music. I've always enjoyed music. And music is there to be enjoyed, right? Music is a way of connecting with your emotions and connecting with other people. And it just brings so much joy, and it always has for me. So for me to be able to play guitar, play a bit of piano, play drums, it's just been a way of being able to extend my connection with music through those instruments. And yeah, growing up in the Page household as a kid was a lot of fun. It was filled with a lot of crazy music and forced my parents to watch many very bad shows in the early days.
Did you have any inkling that you wanted to be a musician? I know you were studying teaching and you know, that story of how you and the other Wiggles met is well known and pretty famous. But did you think about a career in music? Was that on the cards or was it left of centre?
I think I always had a gut feeling or an intuitive feeling that I would be doing something with music. But it kind of got to the point in late high school when I thought it's never going to happen because, you know, to have a career in music or to have a job in music that would pay you and support you was very unlikely. Not everybody is successful in music. You know, you try it and it's hard work. So I think I'd made the decision that I was probably going to end up working on the behind-the-scenes side of music as a roadie. So that's when I actually met Anthony and Jeff because they were playing in a group called the Cockroaches.
Yeah.
That I was a fan of as a teenager in high school. And I ended up doing work experience for the Cockroaches as a roadie, as a sound engineer.
Oh, wow.
And it was that connection with Anthony that he said to me, look, mate, you know, you're young. You're not going to be wanting to be a roadie when you're 50 years old. Is there something else you want to do? And I said, well, look, if anything, I'd probably like to be a teacher because growing up as a child, a lot of my teachers brought music into the classroom with a guitar and they'd sing to us. And to me, that connection with music as a child was really important. So I thought, well, if I could do anything with music, then as a teacher, that would be one way of being able to inject music into people's lives. So Anthony said, well, I'm doing early childhood teaching. You should come and check this course out. And that's really where it began for me, the journey with the Wiggles, because it took me from that behind the scenes role in music where I thought I would end up being to connecting with Anthony and Jeff and Murray and creating the Wiggles. And that changed my world.
And just for the record, I was a fan of the Cockroaches back in the 80s too. They were a really good band. Loved them.
For me, what it was with the Cockroaches was that they were a good, fun, clean, wholesome band that was just about enjoying music. And to me, that's what music was for. It was to enjoy. And the vibe that they had when they performed live was so energetic and so full of life that it was just contagious, the fun that they had. And I think some of that energy carried over into the Wiggles, and we had a lot of fun in the Wiggles with what we did.
So what were those early days like as the Wiggles? You know, you started off, I mean, did you know that it was going to be a big success? I mean, what was it like?
Oh, well, it was just fun, and that's all we did it for. We just wanted to have fun and make music fun for kids. And, you know, our main goal was to create developmentally appropriate entertainment for children, which meant because we were studying early childhood teaching, we learned a lot about child psychology and what was appropriate for kids. So all we wanted to do was create songs that were appropriate for kids, and we had a lot of fun doing it. And I think it's because of a number of reasons, you know. But look, it was hard work. It wasn't an overnight success. No. But the fact that it was fun meant that we stuck at it. I mean, if you took four other blokes and said, we want to pay you to go out on the road and do this, they'd have given up because it was hard work. It wasn't fun if you weren't into it. If you're doing it just to make money, you'd be giving up because there wasn't money in it in those early days. And so because we did it for the right reasons, that's why it became successful. We had the right formula and we had the right motivation behind what we did.
It's really interesting because I've seen some of the early photos of you guys, and I think, you know, one of the photos I think is with Anthony wearing a spotty top, or maybe it's you wearing a spotty top, and there's no sign of skivvies, there's no primary colours, there's no any of that sort of stuff. When did all that come about? And was that by design, or was that just something that happened organically?
It was by design, and luckily it happened only after about a year of wearing those awful shirts that we wore in the first album cover. So those shirts that you described, the spotty, colourful ones, they were only there for about a year. Then when we did our second album in 92, somebody, I think it might have been our manager at the time, he raised the question, well, what's your look going to be for the second album? And I think it was Anthony that said, let's go with primary colours on top, just bold colours and black pants. And that's when the look changed, and that's when it stuck to, you know, the four colours that we had. And the iterations of those skivvies changed over the years, but the colours remained. And it was, you know, a really good thing because it became a way of kids being able to identify each wiggle without having to know their name. And today, you know, the band has gone through so many different versions that there's still those four colours, even though they're actually worn by two people at a time. There's two purple wiggles, two blue wiggles, two yellow and two red, two whatever colour I left out there. But you get the point, right? It's about the colours, not the people. And even though the people and their personalities play an important role, The Wiggles really now is about the colours, and whoever steps into those colours, whilst they need to be able to fulfil that role of being nurturing and caring for the child and engaging for the child, the colours is what the Wiggles is known for. And, yeah, it's funny to think back that after, well, it was 30-something years ago now that we made that decision, and that one decision is probably one of the few things that remains constant throughout the time with the Wiggles.
Did you realise it was a smart decision like that at the time? Did you have any inkling at that time that, you know, the Wiggles was going to be about the colours? Because obviously, I'm skipping forward a little bit, you had your health challenges and stepped away from singing for a while, and I think Sam was the next yellow wiggle. Was that colour situation designed from the get-go to be able to go, you know, if Greg's sick or Murray's sick, we can bring in another red wiggle or a yellow wiggle or a blue? That was just a happy coincidence?
Yeah, and it wasn't really probably until we had to swap people out, because for the first however many years, yeah, we were pretty constant in all the live shows. There weren't a lot of absences by the four of us, which was a really good thing. But then it got to the point where, you know, we got older, we got a bit unhealthier, touring took its toll on us. We had to step out from time to time and bring other people in. And sure, you could just slot them into that yellow skivvy or the blue skivvy in Anthony's case. And that helped that, you know, there was still a blue wiggle there or a yellow wiggle there. And certainly now, as I said earlier, the fact that it's changed so many times, those colours have remained constant. But it wasn't something that we thought about at the time back when we created that idea. The creation of the solid colours was really just from a visual perspective of what would look good and what would engage kids.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think it's really, really clever. Obviously, you know, the benefit of hindsight being a wonderful teacher, it's given that band so much flexibility to change the lineup as circumstances require. And I think there's some good business lessons in there as well. You know, it's not being attached to an individual, in our case, an individual dentist. It's the practice. How do we build that flexibility into the workforce so that, you know, if it's one dentist or another. It's, you know, in our world, maybe not skivvy colours, but the same kind of idea, right? So it's a really useful thing.
Yeah, it's about building a culture, and a culture that connects with your customers. In our case, it was an audience, but they were customers, right? And we had to build that culture that was going to connect with them. And the foundation of our culture was based on developmentally appropriate entertainment for kids.
Yeah.
And as long as we held true to that principle, we could do a lot of things around that principle and give us a lot of freedom and try a lot of things that didn't always work, but we were bound to that solid foundation. And as long as we stuck to that, we found that it's carried through for 30-something years. And I think you're right. In any business, you've got to have a core principle or a core, you know, foundation that you bind your whole business practice to, that you always come back to and say, well, are we acting in accordance with this, or are we outside of that?
I'm curious to ask about the popularity of the Wiggles, because anyone who's ever knows that the Wiggles are one of Australia's most successful bands of all time. In fact, I was reading, this is going back some years ago, I was reading the list of Australia's most successful entertainers, and you and AC/DC were listed at the top. And I'm thinking, what an interesting juxtaposition that is, right? it's like AC/DC and the Wiggles. Never would I see those on the same list normally. But I'm curious to ask you about, you know, when things started to click, you know, when the business side started to click, and what sort of advice did you need to take? What sort of things were you having to consider? Because it's one thing to have the four of you performing and staying true to your culture, but then to be able to turn that into the enterprise that it's become, that's a whole next level of skill set and knowledge and so on. So I'm just curious to ask about that journey.
It was a very interesting journey, because none of us were really business people. I guess I had an interest in business. Jeff had run some businesses with his brother, so he had a bit of business experience and background. But yeah, it presented its challenges, certainly, because we were the business. You know, we were the four individuals that were the face of the business. We were the company directors. We were the ones sort of responsible for making the decisions at that sort of board level. So it grew over time, and we had management in the sort of typical style of band managers. So a band would have a manager who looks after the management of the band, booking the gigs, all those sorts of things. But there was a point where it changed to being more than just managing a band. It became managing a brand. And that's when things had to change for us, and we had to adopt a different model. So that's when we bought an office premises. We employed staff to help us and support us in our roles in terms of being the owners and the directors of the business. And that was a pretty big step. That was around about 96, maybe 95 it might have even been. So about 4 years into our journey, and we were ready to take that step. And from there, it kind of grew and grew and grew again, to the point where now the guys have a big office and studio here in the northwest part of Sydney. They've had that for about, gosh, I'd have to say, I don't know, it feels like probably 18 years now. They've had that one office and studio space, which is flourishing for them, and it served them really well. So yeah, that transition from band to brand was really a big learning curve for us, and we learned a lot about the types of people that we needed to engage with to help us grow the brand or the business, and the types of people that we needed to watch out for in that space as well. So it was really interesting.
So just on that, the type of people you needed to engage with, who did you have on your team, just in terms of, was it lawyers, accountants, you know, what sort of people were making up that team for you?
So in the early days, it was Anthony's brother Paul had left his job that he was doing, and he came on as like an office manager, I think, in the early days. Might have been general manager, I can't remember the exact term. But he was very much in charge of sort of the everyday operations of the business. And we had some staff that sat underneath him. We outsourced some legal advice, you know, legal representation. But we were looking at things like trademarks and a whole lot of things that we'd never done. And it was a new world for us. So we needed good advice. And we got advice from a few different places. I was going to say it's a minefield. It's not a minefield. It was just something that was new to us.
Yeah.
But at the same time, very exciting, because, you know, whilst we're spending a fortune on getting these trademarks, there was a lot of things that we had to navigate in that space. So, for instance, there were people in other parts of the world that already had some of the trademarks that we wanted, so we had to negotiate how that was going to play out. And I'll give you a really crazy example.
Yeah.
We had a trademark for a character called Wags the Dog.
Yep.
Now, Robert De Niro made a movie back in, I don't know what year it was, maybe the early 2000s, called Wag the Dog. And so we had to negotiate around that thing, that if he wanted to do merchandise for that movie, Wag the Dog, how that might infringe upon our trademark, Wags the Dog, even though we were for a children's space. So these are the kinds of things that four blokes growing up in Sydney had no idea we'd ever be contemplating.
Now, if I'm not mistaken as well, if I've heard this story correctly, Robert De Niro actually came to one of your concerts at one point with his grandchild. Is that correct?
No, his son. His son, yeah. And I read a story the other day about De Niro. He's actually a father again, and I think that son is now like in his 20s or something. I read the story, like De Niro's got seven kids or something, and it spoke about this child who must be in his 20s, and that would have been the one that he brought to our show that day.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. So full circle, Wags the Dog coming to the show, the whole thing. What about the other characters, you know, like Captain Feathersword and Dorothy, and where were they born from, and how important was it to have them as support members of the band?
The characters were really important, and, you know, even though, you know, characters like Dorothy the Dinosaur, Wags the Dog and Henry the Octopus, they could sort of be played by anybody because they're suited characters. But Captain Feathersword has been one actor now for the past, gosh, I don't even know the math, not 30 years, but probably 26 years or something like that. Paul Paddock,
yeah.
Yeah, he's an amazing actor. And, yeah, he really made the character of Captain Feathersword his own, although Anthony would probably disagree with that because in the early days Anthony played Captain Feathersword and did a very good job of it. In fact, okay. If you've ever seen those early videos, you've got to watch Anthony's performance as Captain Feathersword.
Okay, I'll check it out. I don't think I've seen those ones. I've seen a lot of the old footage, but I don't think I've seen that one, so I'll check it out. So those characters, though, what dimension did they add to the show, to the business? And again, I'm thinking probably trademarks and all those sorts of things had to happen in there as well for all of that.
Yeah, well, look, it's funny because when we created these characters, we had no idea of the implications of the need to trademark them down the track. We kind of knew that they would be potentially licensable characters or, you know, merchandisable characters, but they weren't created for that reason. They were created to give us an extra dimension and an extra way of connecting with the kids in terms of having a character on stage that the kids could identify with. So Dorothy the Dinosaur, kids love dinosaurs. It's a fantastical creature. You know, it's a fantasy creature, but they were real at one time. And I think that's what kids love about dinosaurs. Like, they know that they were real, but they're not here today. So they're this mythical creature, and they're incredible creatures. They're huge. They're something foreign, but something the kids love to find out about. So that's really why we incorporated Dorothy into our show. She's the friendly dinosaur that eats roses, so she's not scary and intimidating. Captain Feathersword, same kind of thing. Kids love pirate characters. Mm. Again, the same kind of philosophy that they're these fantasy kind of characters, but they were real. They know them from fairy tales and stories. But again, how do you make a pirate character non-threatening and friendly? Well, you give him a feather as a sword that he can only tickle people with and he can't hurt people. So things like that. That's really why we gave birth to these characters, to add an extra dimension to what we could do on stage as the Wiggles, but provide kids with this fantastical experience with four humans on stage and these four sort of fantasy creatures or characters.
It's really interesting you mentioned that, because when I came to the show with our kids, our kids are older now, but I remember as much as they enjoyed coming to see you guys, particularly my youngest daughter, all she wanted to do was see Dorothy. And it was great because she, you know, we had Dorothy merch from wall to wall, mate. I think we still have it. But in any event, I really appreciate the supporting characters there. And again, what I'm thinking about that is going back to your culture, going back to your team, yeah, from a business point of view, is the support roles, again, very, very important. And they play a massive role in allowing the stars of the show, in this case the Wiggles, to do what they do without kind of crowding the stage, but adding another dimension, as you say. So I think there's some good stuff there.
And I think importantly too, there's a couple of other features of having those characters. So number one, when we were on stage, we'd do 3 or 4 shows a day sometimes. So they're quite physically demanding shows. So when Dorothy came out, it gave us a breather. So we could, right? So support staff, support personnel, make sure you use them. And we did. But we didn't do it in a way that was just to let us have a break. It was meaningful for the audience. So draw upon your resources in a way that you can create a meaningful experience. That's what we did. We also created an additional show that could tour on its own. It was the Dorothy the Dinosaur Show. So Dorothy could go out on tour with the other characters, played by a number of people, with a couple of other hosts. And the hosts would sort of fulfill the role of what the Wiggles would normally do, but they would just sing the Wiggles songs, and it could be anybody. In fact, Sam, who took over from me in 2006 when I left the group, we found him for that Dorothy the Dinosaur show initially. And, you know, he went out on tour with Dorothy and the other characters and would do those shows. So, yeah, support staff, support personnel, support characters. They play a very important role in a business if you can utilise them correctly.
Yeah, again, some really interesting insights, and I love the comparisons there. I'm interested to ask, you mentioned Sam taking over your role as the Yellow Wiggle. What was that like stepping away? I mean, you'd been so invested in the Wiggles, you'd been there from the inception, you'd gone through this incredible ride. Was it an easy decision or a hard decision to step away? I know there's some health challenges in amongst that, but I'm just curious to ask.
Look, it was really the health challenges that made the decision for me. It was a tough decision to make, of course, but at the time I made the decision, I didn't have a diagnosis for what was causing me to feel unwell. And we didn't know how long the diagnosis was going to take, and there were some deals that the Wiggles needed to sign, and they needed me to sign up to those deals and say that I could commit to them, but I didn't know if I could, so I couldn't carry on. And I thought, it's not fair on them. It wasn't fair on me. It was actually causing me a lot of stress at the time. I was also going through a marriage breakdown at that point in time as well. So there was a lot of emotional stress that was probably adding to my physical woes at the point in time. It was a very tough time, but it was the right decision at that point in time. And look, life happens and you make decisions and life plays out in a certain way. And look, I've been very fortunate to have the chance to go back to the Wiggles in 2012 for a year. The guys asked me to go back for a year and got a great relationship with the guys, and we're still doing shows as the OG Wiggles today. So, yeah, things happen for a reason and life takes its turns, and you've got to go with it. There's no other option, right? You can't change life. You've just got to go where it takes you.
Yeah, 100%. And just a detour for a second, the word on the street is you're a bit of an Elvis fan as well.
Yeah.
How did you get into Elvis so much?
So my interest in Elvis began because of Anthony in the Wiggles.
And oh, wow.
Yeah, when we were on tour in the early days, we'd travel around Australia. We'd just hire a tarago. And back in the days of cassette tapes,
oh, I remember them.
Cassette tape in the deck in the car.
Yep.
And listen to Elvis as we traveled around. We listened to a lot of things, but it was really the Elvis stuff that grabbed me that Anthony would put in, particularly the 1970s music where Elvis was playing live with an orchestra, but band, the TCB band, and he had, you know, 8 vocalists singing on stage. It was this big sound, right? You got this big sound with Elvis's voice, and it was really, it just grabbed me. And then when we went to Graceland for the first time in, I think it was 98, we were on tour in the US and we had a day off in Memphis. And Anthony said, guys, we're going to pay homage to the king. We're all going to Graceland. And I was kind of like, oh, man, I just need a day off. I need some time to rest. And he dragged me along, and I'm glad he did, because when I went through Graceland and I found out more about Elvis, it wasn't so much the fact that he was a great singer, that he was adored by people all over the world. It was the man that really intrigued me. The fact that he was so spiritual, he was philanthropic, he had problems that he had to deal with off stage, just like everybody does in life. You know, you go to work, you put on your work face, you do your work, you leave your problems behind. Elvis did the same thing. When he was on stage, that was his happy place and he could sing and do what he loved. But it didn't take away from the fact that he had issues that he had to deal with outside of that. And those problems, I think, over time compounded for him and made him, you know, feel a little bit unsure about life. And, you know, it's interesting talking about dentistry, but, you know, Elvis had a dentist that he went to see the day before he passed away. And that that trip to the dentist there is known as being his last sort of medical appointment before he passed away. So there's some really interesting things about Elvis in his life, and I connected with his story on a number of levels, and that's really where the interest began.
And is it true that you get to the Parks Festival when that's on? Is it true that you're out there doing all that sort of stuff?
I go along every now and then. I don't go every year. It's a big festival. It's huge, and it's at a hot time of year out there in Parks. So, you know, when it's middle of January and it's 40-something degrees, you've got all these people running around in their jumpsuits. I don't know how they do it, but I don't dress up like Elvis.
Just to be clear, I know you're not doing that, but I did know you were a fan. I just to fast forward a little bit, you mentioned that going back to the Wiggles for a second, you tour as the OG Wiggles, and in 2020 you were on stage, and I was watching the footage of that this morning where you had a heart attack and collapsed. What was that like? What did you experience? And obviously had good people around you to help you and resuscitate you, but what was that experience like?
Yeah, well, at the time, it was just like any other show that I'd done that was hard work. And there's been numerous times over the years when if you do a show and it's hard work, you just feel exhausted and you just want to lie down. And that's how I felt. So you correctly said I had a heart attack, which I did. I had a massive heart attack, but that heart attack was so massive that it sent me into cardiac arrest. So heart attack and cardiac arrest are two different things. The heart attack is the blockage of the artery or arteries in the heart that prevent the blood flow getting to the heart muscle. And that causes problems, of course, but cardiac arrest is when your heart stops beating. So the blockage of my artery was so massive that my heart just went haywire, and the cardiac arrest is an electrical problem with the heart. And when the electrical impulses of the heart get disrupted, the heart doesn't beat. It kind of fibrillates and shakes. So, yeah, as you said, luckily for me, there were people around who recognized that I wasn't breathing and that I needed to be resuscitated. So they started CPR. They called 000, first of all, started CPR. And thankfully, there was an AED or defibrillator at that venue where we were performing. It was able to be retrieved and brought to my responders, and they used it within 10 minutes. And second shock from the defib, and I had what they call ROSC, or return of spontaneous circulation, just as the paramedics were arriving. So, yeah, I was a very, very lucky man.
That's not an experience that, you know, you'd wish upon anyone. But obviously, in your case, it's had a happy ending. I guess, you know, first and foremost, you look well. I'm assuming you're well. I hope so. I can't help but wonder what reflections come about as a result of that near-death experience, because, you know, most people go through life and then, frankly, they kind of pop their clogs and they're gone. You've had the opportunity, and I don't want to use the word glibly because I don't mean that to sound like I'm being dismissive in any way, shape or form, but it's not every day you have that jolt in life that says, hey, buddy, maybe you want to think about a few things in your life, maybe do some things the same, do some things differently. What reflections did you have on that experience? What have you learned about yourself? What have you committed to doing differently moving forward?
I think one thing that really struck me was just how lucky or fortunate I was to survive. 10% of people survive a cardiac arrest, so it's got a very low survival rate. And what struck me then after that was that I can't believe that it has such a low survival rate, given that there is what we call this thing, the chain of survival, and it's what bystanders can do to save a life, and that is call, push, shock. And that's why I survived, because my responders were able to do those three things. Now, those three things don't always result in survival, but when those three things are in place, people have a much greater survival rate.
Yeah.
So I resolved that I was going to try and use my notoriety to raise awareness about this. And that's been the biggest change, that I now donate my time to a charity that I established to raise awareness. You know, on other levels, there are other things that I think about and do differently. But the biggest impact that it's had on my life is that this is what I spend my time doing now, and that is trying to save more lives that can be saved by educating people about what they can do if they see somebody collapse. you know, I've been given a second chance and I've been given an opportunity to do something, you know, I was going to say more meaningful with my life. I mean, what I did with the Wiggles was meaningful. Having a family is meaningful. All those things I wouldn't be able to do now if I wasn't here.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I get to go home to my family every single day, even though I might sit here in this office for 8 hours and not see them for that part of the day. I now get to go home when otherwise I wouldn't have. So it makes me look at life a little bit differently. And I think too, this might sound a bit strange and it's probably not answering your question fully, but because I've always had a view that there is me, Greg Page, and then there's Greg Wiggle.
Yep.
It was Greg Wiggle that had that experience on stage, right?
Uh-huh.
So it's a weird thing, right? So I can kind of dissociate myself from it to a large extent. But I know that I'm the guy with the heart disease. I know that I'm the guy that collapsed and now has to look after himself better, because if I don't, that could happen again. And I think that's the other scary thing, that my heart disease was diagnosed by that cardiac arrest. And that's the case for about 50% of people that have a sudden cardiac arrest. They don't know they've got heart disease until they drop dead.
Yeah.
And like I said, only 10% of people survive. So for other families, they've got a partner, a father, a mother, whoever it is, going about their life every day, going out and exercising, thinking that they're healthy, but they don't understand that there's something going on inside of them. And that's why they call heart disease the silent killer.
Mm.
I had none of the risk factors, none of the warning signs. You know, I could have seen my GP that morning and he would have said, for 48 years old, you're doing well.
Yeah.
And I'd have had no idea. And I did have no idea. And yeah. Anyway, that's why I do this, because there's so many people out there that I think that we can save who don't know they've got heart disease, because the prevention, the awareness, the education about heart disease hasn't worked for whatever reason. But doesn't mean we can't save these people or we shouldn't. And that's the goal that I have.
So, Greg, the importance of AEDs can't be overstated. Obviously, dentists have an AED in their dental practice. Most practices would have that. And I know you've got a foundation called Heart of the Nation. Tell us a bit about what AEDs are doing in that particular space there, what you're thinking about there.
If dentists have an AED in their practice, we would encourage dentists to think about making them publicly accessible for members of the community that might need them in the event of cardiac arrest. We actually have a program with Heart of the Nation where you can register your AED with us, and we'll send you out some stickers to place on the front door or window of your business, so that people, even if they're not coming into your practice, they might just be walking past every day and they'll see the sign or the sticker and they'll know that there's an AED inside. And if somebody collapses around the corner and they're not breathing, if that bystander needs access to an AED and they know there's one there at your practice, if they can come and grab it from you, take it and use it to try to save a life, that'd be an amazing thing. So if you do have an AED at your practice, you can register it with Heart of the Nation. We'll send you out those stickers and we'll show the location of your AED on our app as well. The app is available in the App Store or on Google Play. Just look up Heart of the Nation and download the app. It shows you the location of more than 7,000 AEDs around Australia. But if you go to heartofthenation.com.au/join, you can actually register there. And we'd love to see dentists signing up everywhere. We've actually already got some who have signed up. So if you've got an AED and you're willing to make it publicly accessible to the community to try and save a life, then we'd really appreciate that. And we'd love to get you registered with Heart of the Nation.
It is tricky to know whether you are as healthy on the inside as you feel on the outside, right?
Yeah, it is. And I think at the moment there is a lot of discussion amongst cardiologists about, well, what can we do? How can we improve this screening? Because you don't want to be sending everybody off for a coronary angiogram or a calcium score test. So it's really difficult. And I think that until we really crack that part of it, and even once we do crack that, we're still going to need people to know how to call push shock, because people are still going to drop dead. Their hearts are going to stop beating for some reason. You know, it's not always heart disease, you know, in the terms of plaque buildup inside the arteries. It's not always that that causes the heart to stop. So, you know, I think we're going to be in this space for a long time trying to make improvements.
Yeah. Thank goodness there's some good researchers with, you know, good brains putting some effort and thought into that. We've covered a lot of territory today, and thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Just as we wrap up, I just wanted to reflect on one or two things about your time with the Wiggles, going back to the beginning of that. one or two questions, if I may. Do you have a favourite Wiggle memory? Do you have a favourite experience or a favourite show or something like that that, you know, you remember as, you know, one of your best all-time Wiggle memories?
Oh, gosh. No, I would have many, and it would be really difficult to try and find one off the top of my head. Look, there's so many things that happened throughout my time with the Wiggles. I was only there 16 years, and look, I think my favourite Wiggle memory is just the camaraderie that we had as four guys, you know, building this thing that became a global business, and we had no idea that it was going to do that. We're very fortunate that we were mates to begin with. We had our disagreements over the years, of course, but throughout all of that, and I think this is a key to building a strong business, that if you have people who are aligned in vision and mission and who are putting that above ego, then you've got a recipe for success. And we always kept each other in check in terms of our egos. We wouldn't let anybody get above what our mission was. It was always about the kids. It wasn't about us. And I think that that's a real key to success, is that you've got to put your audience and your business first, because when it becomes about you, it's no longer about your customer.
Yeah, I love that. Thank you, mate. That's fantastic. And finally, mate, I told a friend of mine that I was going to be interviewing you today, and he said, "Jesse, tell me one thing. You've got to be doing a bit of the finger work for me." And so I just had to say, who came up with that? Where did that come from?
Well, my recollection of this is that when we used to tour Australia, we'd have 4 weeks away from home, but we'd have weekends off, and we'd be sitting in the hotel watching TV. And during the test match cricket, in the lunch break, they used to play 10-pin bowling. There were these two 10-pin bowlers from South Australia called Brenton and Silvano. So Brenton and Silvano, when they got a strike, they'd turn around to their partner and they'd go like this. They didn't have the thumbs, right? So they did this. And Murray one day came back on stage and he came out and he said, "Hey, Wiggles," and he did this with the thumbs. And we went, "Oh, that's fantastic. Where'd you get that from?" He said, "Oh, you know, those bowlers, they did this. You know, I just did that." And so anyway, that became something that we did on stage. And then it became something that we did in photographs, because it gave us something to do with our hands. You know, in photographs, you want your hands to be seen, so there can't be any question over where your hands are. So we did that in photos as well, and that just kind of became our thing.
Mate, that's fantastic. So, Greg, thanks so much for taking the time to come and talk to us today, mate. You've been absolutely fun to talk to. It's been a thrill to get to meet you. And from all of us here at Savvy Dentist, mate, appreciate your time so much.
Pleasure. Thanks, Jesse. Lovely to talk to you, mate.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast. For more episodes, go to drjessegreen.com/savvydentist. And to discover how to build a high-performance dental practice, visit drjessegreen.com and download the free report.